I've been thinking, particularly yesterday, thinking about how the Christmas season is, our celebration of it is emblematic of why Christ came and what it changes now that He came, but this tension of this not being it yet. We celebrate Christmas and it's beautiful, and relationships are great, and kids, the looks on their faces, I mean, just, you know, seeing kids sing like this is it's a marvelous time of year, and yet it all at times comes crumbling down too and falls short, or just has its shortcomings in small ways. Yesterday, I was wrapping my wife's presents, and the two older girls were helping me, and I was messing it up in bad ways, and it was patchwork. It was bad. I was wishing it was like drywall, because you could put something on it and sand over it, and you don't know that you had to fix it. It's not like that with wrapping paper, is it? And the kids were trying to encourage me. They told me it was the best wrapping they had ever seen me do, which just means I'm that bad. So, you know, but we're having this special time, and yet you can't get the wrapping paper to work. At least I can't, because I'm not good at it. You know, you can't get it to do what you want it to do. Oh, no, we're out, you know, or the one piece. You know, you're trying to get all the presents to be the same wrapping paper. You put them in a big stack, and, oh, you ran out. And it's just funny. It's emblematic of our whole Christmas, and emblematic of this time we live in where Christ has brought so much, and yet we know there is more to come. It's the case with peace. So if you'd look at Luke chapter 2 with me, I'd like to focus our attention on verse 14. Verse 14 records what the angels said, a multitude of angels, to the shepherds. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among men with whom He's pleased. Christmas time is peaceful, and yet sometimes it's not. And so we see in verse 14 this concept that Christ brought peace. I'd like to talk first about the meaning of peace here in Luke chapter 2. You might know the New Testament was written in Greek. And the Greek word translated peace here is eirene. Eirene in the New Testament just means peace. It's a very good translation for Luke chapter 2 verse 14. It's peace. And you think of our English word peace, that it has a broad scope of meaning. What it meant in the 70s to a hippie, it means something different to the UN. And what it means to a mom of three boys who's trying to get them to not fight. You know, peace and quiet means something totally different. In the Old Testament, written in Hebrew, the concept of peace was in this word shalom. Hebrew shalom, meaning peace, but not peace like our English word where it can have a variety of different meanings and it depends on context to know what we mean. Or even like the Greek word, eirene. The Old Testament Hebrew was picturing this peace that was comprehensive, that was holistic, we could say. It had to do with completeness, of welfare, of health, of safety, of soundness. It was a comprehensive peace. Not just the absence of injustice, not just the absence of war, not just the absence of discontentedness or the absence of sickness. The Old Testament concept of shalom, peace, was peace with God to start with. Peace with God is the most important aspect of peace. But peace with God then affecting and effecting peace with others. Peace in our relationships. Peace in our own hearts. Peace about our purpose in this world. Peace about circumstances. Peace about life and what we're here to do. Peace about the future. And peace with others. Peace that's not just personal, but it hinted at this peace that is societal. The concept is often referred to when talking about this Old Testament shalom peace was that it was a fabric. It was something like a fabric weaved into people's lives and connected into other people's lives. That's the idea of shalom here. And even though the New Testament's written in Greek, not Hebrew, we should think Hebrew shalom when we come to Luke chapter 2 and hear this word peace in verse 14. That's how the shepherds are going to hear this. They're Old Testament guys. They're Jewish, we suspect. And so when they hear he's come to bring peace, they think shalom. Even though Luke records it in Greek, it's this concept that was filled and littered through the Old Testament. This concept of shalom. Christ is that shalom. Now let's talk about the need for peace. If the coming of Jesus meant a coming of pervasive peace, a coming of comprehensive peace, we should realize what that means for Christmas. We should realize what that means for tomorrow. We should realize what that means in our lives. You may not agree with me that Jesus is the answer for this comprehensive peace. But let's start out by talking about this need for peace. I think we can all agree that there is a need for something. Something is awry. Something is wrong. Something needs fixing. And so I want to talk to you about six or so voices from within. I don't mean when you hear voices. Hopefully you don't. But these voices, how do we describe them? You know, they call them voices or a heartbeat or something. You can take your pick on how to describe them. But there are these universal longings in the human heart. It's universal desire. And it's, we could say, it's a desire for shalom. It's a push towards shalom. A pull within us towards wanting things fixed. And we could say in each one of these that there's a pull and a push. The pull draws us in because we know it needs to be and we pursue it. But the push back in each of these indicates that it never really gets fulfilled. It really never is ultimate. So I said six of these in mind, and I think you'll see what I mean as we go through these things. Things that hint at the pervasive peace that we need in Jesus. The first is justice. This first one is actually what I mentioned last week as we thought about judgment in the book of 2 Peter. I said last week that you don't have to explain justice to children on a playground. That's C.S. Lewis's picture in Mere Christianity. He says, kids just know on a playground what justice is. They say, that's not fair. They don't need to be handed the UN declaration of what justice is. They don't even need to know the word justice. They just know taking something from someone is unfair. That's not fair. And so it's in us. It's universally in us. Even if we think it fleshes out in different ways. If your idea of justice is different than mine, notice that we have concepts of justice. We all, in every society, have a concept of justice, even if it varies one country, one culture to another. We demand justice. We want justice. In many cases, we pursue justice. But we said last week, it's funny, we don't want justice of ourselves, do we? Not always. Not when we're bad. You know, when you get pulled over by the police officer for speeding, you don't want justice, you want mercy. When kids are in trouble with their parents, all of a sudden now they don't want what's fair, they want grace, they want mercy, they want a gift, they want a free pass. And when we get to heaven and face the Lord, our Creator, our Maker, we won't want justice, we will want mercy. So it's funny that we want justice, we think we do. We pursue justice in most things. We seek out justice. We know what justice is to some extent. And yet we never seem to fully achieve any global justice, any real, final justice. Proof of that is right in our own hearts that we really don't want justice of ourselves. We want mercy. There's a push and a pull. Think about the voice from within of spirituality. That's the catchphrase today, spirituality. It's an applause word. Everyone likes it. It used to just be religion, but that's kind of out of vogue. Now today it's spirituality. And spirituality today is something that all of us in some way or another pursue. You see it at Christmas time as there's just in anybody almost a pursuit of something spiritual, something metaphysical, something beyond the here and the now and the in just what you can see and what you can touch. And so some people, you know, pursue that in weird things like looking for ghosts, I guess. Other people pursue it in formal religions. And today, with the spirituality focus we have, it's people saying, I don't believe in God, but I'm spiritual. kind of go, well, what is that spiritual thing? And you ask some questions and find out that they've kind of made up their own religion in a sense. They've kind of made up their own spirituality. They take a little bit from this guy, a little bit from that religion, a little bit from this book, a little bit from Oprah and Dr. Phil maybe. And you put it together and it's Ryanology or whatever your first name is, right? You just kind of make it your own. That can't be the answer, can it? Again, a push and a pull. We're pulled toward this thing of spirituality, and yet we can't agree on what it is or how we pursue it, and we're not certain where we go for the answers. Think about joy. We have it in us to laugh. We have it in us to celebrate. In fact, in some ways, our culture makes a god almost out of a trite sort of joy, a quick sort of pleasure. But even where that pursuit of joy and pleasure is bigger, deeper, longer lasting. It's within us to pursue joy. It's within us to pursue pleasure. We may not all enjoy the same things. We may not all find the same amount of pleasure in one thing. But even where pursuit of pleasure is twisted, or when we can't agree on what it is and how it should be done, at least we can agree that we do pursue joy. We do pursue pleasure. And yet, I think we could also agree we never really get it. Not fully, not completely. None of us really reach joy. On a scale of 1 to 10, 11. You don't get there, do you? Everything is that was nice, it fades. That was good, it's gone. That's really nice, but it's rusty. And so we pursue this pleasure in bigger and better and newer, always trying to get to something that's eternal and complete and full joy and never really getting there. You think of beauty. Beauty as a desire to make beauty and as a desire to admire beauty, to notice beauty. Beauty drives much of what we think and what we do and what we pursue. Beauty's tough to define, though. So how you define beauty and what you think is beautiful is going to be different than how I think. But isn't it interesting, even with all of our different opinions about what is beautiful and how we find beauty, how we make beauty, we all know what beauty is. There's a desire within us to create beauty, to admire beauty, and science doesn't have a graph for that. Do you realize that? Science doesn't have a graph for why you want something beautiful as opposed to something ugly, and how you even have those metaphysical categories that something is pleasing to the eye, something is pleasing to the ear, something is pleasing to the touch. And yet Ecclesiastes says, rightfully so, the eye is never filled with seeing. The ear is never filled with hearing. You know what that means? You never say, it's been so beautiful, I'm just shutting my eyes. I'm done. That's it. I'm done. I don't have to look for the rest of my life. I've seen enough pretty flowers. Close the eyes. I'm done. I'm too tired of beautiful. No. We don't say that about hearing things. We always want a new CD. We always want to find better music. Musicians are always trying to make better music. Poets are trying to make better poems. They're constantly in pursuit of perfection, of beauty. And because they make a new one, it's proof they never really achieve that perfection of beauty. Think of a love of music that leads someone to study music formally and academically. What you often find is that someone who does that will go through a long period, maybe for the rest of their life, where they really don't enjoy music because they have to study it every time they hear it. All they do is critique it. All they do is dissect it and analyze it. That happens actually with theology too. It's interesting. Those who study theology, those who study the Bible on an academic formal level, oftentimes, sadly, come to miss the joy that led them to study it in the first place, and everything becomes merely analytical and picking it apart and dissecting it. Think about Christmas time. Christmas time is beautiful. It celebrates beauty unlike any other season that I know. We dress up. We decorate our homes. And it's not usually like pop culture kind of decorating of homes. It's not like a Halloween version. I'm not necessarily against Halloween and the celebration of it necessarily, but what you do find, I think we can agree on this, that Halloween is joking stuff and weird stuff and funny stuff as opposed to Christmas when we want to beautify our homes. We decorate a tree, and here's the classic example of beauty that fades. We beautify a tree, and if it's real, it dies in a couple of weeks. I mean, that's a perfect example of Ecclesiastes. The pursuit of beauty, and it just disappears like a dusty old tree. Either stuffed in your garage for next year or withering as it goes back to the earth. Think about relationships. Think about not just the physical, the sex. That is its own lesson where we're obsessed and we pursue it. But then there's an ongoing cycle of restlessness, of pursuing a better, pursuing a different. But physical aside, think emotionally about relationships. We were made for relationships. It's in us. Even the guy who says, I'm a loner. I bet he doesn't want to live on Mars. You know, there's even now in kind of interaction with people, which we get it through things like internet and TV. Now, we're not actually interacting with them, but the person who says they're a loner, if you take away their internet connection, I bet they would feel a little too alone, right? There's this connection of just news, of people, of information, of discussion, even if it's not blogs, even if it's not chat rooms. It's within us to have relationships, but we also know they are messy and imperfect. I mean, fixing marriages is, what, a $1 billion industry? You know, relationships, how to make them work. A few books have been written on that, haven't they? Yeah, because we're all messed up. We all have, we call them issues. You know, you're an issue-filled home. It's just degrees of dysfunctionality, isn't it? I mean, we're all kind of working at relationships, enjoying them, and being frustrated by them. Again, Christmas time, a time where we love each other, where we come together, Christmas sweaters, smiles, Bing Crosby on in the background. And then someone says something stupid at the dinner table, and Bing Crosby can't fix it. Nothing can. And you go on, and that's life. Think about meaning and purpose. Meaning and purpose. This category in some ways is an umbrella over the previous five. It's that search for truth and meaning and purpose that's within all of us, even if some of us do it to a higher degree, to a greater extent than others. No doubt, some of us focus on the meaning of life, philosophical questions we could say, more than others. But none of us can fully and completely ignore those questions about what is right and what is wrong. Is there something called morality? And if so, who decides it? If you mess up on morality, do you have to pay for it? And when will you? What's on the other side of death? Did God create anything? Is He really there? What's He like? It's within us to ask those questions even if we don't want to. And so Romans 1 says that we suppress the truth in unrighteousness. It's the idea of like stomping on truth, trying to get above a trash can that you're in. You're trying to not own up to it. You're trying to pretend that He isn't there. You're trying to pretend that morality isn't a reality. And so if there's no morality, then maybe there's no punishment for immorality. If there's no God, maybe there's no God I have to answer to or hear what He says to me over. So all of these relationships and beauty and joy, truth, meaning, purpose, all these, this is the purpose of any and every religion. Do you realize this? The purpose of any and every religion is to ask these questions, to talk about these things, to explain why it's a universal pursuit that we do these things and other things. Just six that I picked out. It's a religious exercise. It's a spiritual exercise to make sense of why at times we're successful with this, why we want justice and why sometimes we see justice in this world. But it's also the job of any religion and every religion to try to figure out why we only see shadows of it, why they're just voices, why it's not perfect, why it's not permanent, why it doesn't last, why it just seems to be, like it says in Ecclesiastes, something that you grasp after, but you grasp like grasping after the wind. You miss. In fact, isn't it funny? This is interesting. Much of our comedy, many of our jokes, our sitcoms, are simply demonstrating the irony and the difficulty, the tension between the pull and the push in these sorts of things. Think about it. Watch a sitcom. With these things in mind, all the jokes can fall into these categories. That's why there's actually a theological category for comedy. There's a Christian explanation for comedy. And so the question we can ask ourselves and should ask ourselves is, what religion answers these questions best? Now, you might think one religion answers that question, these questions, these issues, better than another. I think Christianity answers these questions so well. It makes sense of these things. Not perfectly, not without mystery, but it makes sense of these things. It makes sense like this. It says, we universally know these things and want these things in our lives and in the world because we're made in the image of God. And God does these things. God is just. God is relational. God creates and likes beauty. We are made in His image, and so it's within us. And we can't deny it. We can't suppress it, even if we twist it. And so the Christian message says we can't get these finally right. We can never really achieve these because of a little dark word called sin. And ever since sin came into the world, these things have been messed up. You see it right from the beginning. Adam and Eve in the garden, right after they sin, God starts to talk with them. Find out from Adam what happened. Adam, what does he do? He blames his wife. It was that wife you gave me. You know, I mean, we're already blaming each other. Just one sentence after sin comes into the world. You get one chapter out of Genesis 3 where sin starts. Genesis 4, the first family, first offspring, Cain kills his brother. It's not just wrong because it's murder. It's wrong because it messes with God's relational love, covenant, His interpersonalness, His desire for others. And He does it right and He does it perfectly. He does it holy and lovingly. And Cain didn't. And so it's wrong, not just because God said it was wrong. It's wrong because it's part of that image of God that's now shattered, not destroyed. The image of God, this side of sin isn't utterly destroyed and it doesn't utterly disappear. That's why we still do these things. We still know these things. We still want these things. But it's shattered like a mirror. If you dropped a hammer on a mirror, you'd look at it and be able to make out something of your own reflection. You would see you. You'd probably know it's you. But man, you don't want to use that mirror all the time. It's not a good reflection of what you look like. And so image of God is there, but not destroyed, shattered. And that's why we don't give up on these things. The Christian message says that we don't take God's good things that He created and get rid of them. We twist them. Sin is a twisting of all these good things. It is a twisting of relationships to instead make it about what you can give me instead of what I can do for you. It is about making relationships about sex instead of love. It is a making of justice that wants it sometimes but doesn't want it for me. Not all the time. The Christian faith makes sense of these things like this. It says, the need is so pervasive that the fix has to be pervasive. Remember? Luke 2. According to Christianity, according to Luke 2, the fix is in shalom. He came to be peace among men. Getting back to my original point here. He came to be peace among men. He came to fix what was wrong. He came to bring a complete, cohesive kind of peace. That's pervasive. That's inside of us. That connects to brain and heart and connects to others and connects to God. It makes sense for society. It makes sense for a community. That's why He came. He came to set things right. We get these things right. We start to get these things right in Jesus. So think about this God of peace with me, Jesus. Jesus is our peace. The God of peace shows us what peace is, shows us peace in the flesh, and gives peace and spreads peace and disseminates His peace in Jesus, His Son, who was God in the flesh. We're told in Ephesians chapter 2 that He Himself is our peace. Just a banner statement. He Himself is our peace. He's our peace. Peace for what? Well, you name it. He is peace among men. He is peace with God. He is peace with each other. He is peace in my heart. He is peace for the future. He is peace for eternity. Listen to what Micah chapter 5 says, an Old Testament passage prophesied of Jesus before he came. Look at what it says up here in the screens. But as for you, Bethlehem, too little to be among the clans of Judah. From you, one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. That's why he was born in Bethlehem. His goings forth are from long ago. How long ago? From the days of eternity. That was God speaking. Now Micah, the prophet, speaks saying, therefore he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. And he will arise and shepherd his flock, just as Jesus said he would. He said he was the shepherd. He'll do it in the majesty of the name of the Lord. He will be great to the ends of the earth. This one will be our peace. So when the prophets speak of peace, and the shepherds hear the angels saying that this one's coming and he'll be our peace, there's a connection made. This is the fix. This is the fix that was prophesied of in Genesis 3, that Satan would be defeated one day. Sin in Satan would be defeated one day in one who would come. This one is Jesus. Oh, you see it in our Christmas songs we sing, our Christmas carols. Listen to O Little Town of Bethlehem. It says, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Hopes and fears. Remember? A pull and a push. The hopes. You're hoping justice can happen. You're hoping joy can happen. You're hoping relationships can actually work without moving to Mars and living by yourself. You're hoping there's meaning and purpose in this world. The hope and fears. You're afraid because you wonder, can I make a relationship work? Can I have a friend that lasts more than a couple of years? I was thinking this week how friendships, like decade-long, super close friendships, why are those so rare? Do you know why? Well, because it's no big deal to move on from friends. It's a bigger deal, even in our culture, to move on from a wife or a husband. Definitely a big deal to move on from kids. But a friend, you get in close, you get to know each other. It's too close. They made you mad. I'm getting a new friend. And you do that. Your whole history of friendship is a cycle of ones you were actually willing to fight through and just say, you know what? Yeah, I can't believe we're friends. We're not a good fit. But we're going to be friends. You know, that takes commitment. That takes hard work. And so all those things, hopes and fears of all the years, O little town of Bethlehem says, are met in thee tonight. That Jesus is the shalom for your messed up friends and your messed up friendships that you've made. Jesus is the shalom for your home. Jesus is the shalom for this community. Jesus came to restore what was broken in sin. We're celebrating his birth then, not celebrating a slice of life. We're not celebrating this religious thing. Christians, let me talk to you. Church-going, Bible-believing, Bible-thumping Christians. This isn't just part of the year. I know we take part of the year to really focus on it. And I think we should do that. But think about it. If this is shalom, Christ's coming is the shalom for our marriage and for my kids and for what I do in the community, what I do in the world, and how I do a job. This isn't just a slice of who I am. This isn't just a religious sector of my life and my heart and my mind. I think we sometimes think of Christmas like that. And we think, even as Christians, we think of maybe Sunday like that. Or maybe you think of Bible study like that. You know, read your Bible in the morning. You gave God His time. Now the rest is yours. You know, you can feel good about going through the day, doing it on your own because you read your Bible. Or giving some money to the poor or to a church. And feeling like you gave it, that's God's money, you might say, now the rest is mine. It's all His. He came to restore things. He came to unite heaven and earth. Notice, look back at Luke 2:14 with me. Look at the text. Glory to God in the highest. That's where God is, heaven. And on earth, peace among men with whom He's pleased. God came down. God came down to us. And now there's a mingling of heaven and earth where shalom is seen. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Think about the recipients of this peace then. The recipients of this peace? It says, peace among men, and that's generic there. It means men or women and or women. With whom he is pleased. Now what you need to know is that we're not naturally at peace with God. And he is not naturally pleased with us. We were made in his image, but all of us, when Adam and Eve sinned, all of us sinned with them. And all of us are born sinful. Just like you don't have to teach kids what justice is, you also don't have to teach them what lying is. How ironic is that? You know, they want justice. Okay, you're in trouble. Justice or lie? I'm going to go with lying on this one. Conveniently so. Isn't that ironic? Yeah, it's because the image of God is still there, but it's shattered. It's broken. And so it's occasional. And it's twisted when it's even there. So they want justice, but not for themselves, and they'll lie to get out of it. So we are not naturally at peace with God. We are not naturally His pleasure. He's not naturally pleased with us. And we're not at peace with others because of that. As that relationship goes, all others tend to go. We can't finally and utterly be restored to others. We finally can't have the categories for relationships working unless we're first restored to the relationship that is most primary, the one that is most essential, relating to our God. But think about this. God is not naturally pleased with us, but He was pleased with His Son. Do you remember that story? Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. Peter sees it. We saw it a couple weeks ago in studying 2 Peter. God says from heaven down to earth, this is my beloved Son in whom I am what? Well pleased, He says. I'm pleased in my Son. So Jesus didn't just come to be born. And Jesus didn't just come to die. In between these, He came to live and to live righteously. So that the Father would say, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. I'm pleased in my Son. Why? Because my Son is obeying. My Son is doing the law. My Son is doing what everyone else who's ever been made, who's ever had a human body, hasn't done. We have sinned. We fall short of the glory of God. So Jesus came to be God's pleasure so that we, by Him, could be pleased from God, and we could have peace. So peace comes to us if He's pleased with us, and He's pleased with us because He's pleased with His Son. But He's at peace with us and pleased with us if we believe. Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith it's impossible to please Him. There's no pleasing God. There's no making that relationship right unless there's faith. But you say, faith in what? Well, faith in what Jesus came to do. Faith in why He was born. He was born, big picture, for peace. Narrow slice, He brings peace through His death. I said earlier how ironic it is. But the answer to the peace problem would be in a baby. Not the UN. You know, as big as that is, it's not the answer to the peace problem. It came in a baby to demonstrate God's mysterious, wonderful ways. In not just a baby, but a baby who would die, who would be murdered. The answer to the peace problem is demonstrated by God in a murder. Murder of His Son. Not God murdering His Son, but God allowing His Son to be murdered at the hands of those He made. Those who sin. Those who deserve judgment. We're told Matthew 1:21, you will call His name Jesus, for He will save His people from their sins. That's why He came. We need saving from our sins. That's where it has to start. Peace with God begins with our sins being forgiven and with our sin being removed. He demands righteousness of us, righteousness which we don't have. That's why Jesus came to live. So the Father be pleased. But He also came to die so that a punishment would be taken, a punishment that we deserve. And that becomes ours. Guilt removed and righteousness received through faith, we're told. By believing that it's so, by embracing it, and by following the one who said it, who is the substance of it. Jesus turns those voices into reality. He fixes those things of justice. He fixes spirituality so that it's not some sort of wacky, make it up, weird buffet of what we want to hear and what makes us feel good until we decide to change it a week later. He makes sense of joy. We're told in Psalm 16:11 that at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. How do you get to his right hand? In his presence is the fullness of joy, Psalm 16 says. How do we get to his presence? There's one mediator. The mediator, the man, Christ Jesus. So this fixes things. Listen to what Paul says in Romans 15. He prays for the Romans and says, may the God of hope fill you with joy and peace in believing. And the Apostle Paul later in Philippians says it like this, that God can give peace to you who believe, peace which passes all understanding. Peace. Shalom. I know what you're thinking, though. If you're not a Christian, you're thinking, Christians don't seem any more peaceable than I am. And history hasn't proven that so well. I mean, sometimes Christians are famous more for war than for the Bible. You're wondering, has Jesus really fixed anything? Heaven and earth coming together? Jesus mingling heaven and earth? Jesus bringing this kind of shalom? You're thinking, yeah, right. But here's what we would say. The Christian message has an answer to that. It says that it's progressive. This peace is spreading, and it's spreading in God's timing. It's spreading slowly. Jesus likened the kingdom to a seed that's very small at the beginning and then springs up. And the growth of that is on his timing. It's in his plans. We don't know. In fact, one of the ways we can translate Luke 2:14 is that it's peace among men of his good pleasure. Another way to translate it is that it's of his good pleasure that he's doing this. He's on his schedule. It might seem like it's slow, but there's a seedling. I would say to you, there's a seedling in my home of shalom. Oh, it's a messy shalom. It's a rusty shalom. It's a, you know, we're trying to caulk the seam shalom. Sometimes we're faking it. But I think that there's something there with their categories and instruction and love and forgiveness and justice and beauty at a level that I didn't know before I was a Christian. I think you'd see it here in our church. A church of you know, Northeast Heights. I guess that's where we are. We're made up of really wealthy people and some really poor people. We have homeless people who come. We have homeless people who are in home groups. We have an ethnic diversity here among us. I mean, just look around. We're a decent representation of the whole of Albuquerque, in a sense. And I think that's because we have something in common that's deeper than hobbies. If you were going to put us all together based on hobbies, a lot of us would go away. A lot of us couldn't be in the same group. If you're going to put us together based on socioeconomic, cultural issues, we wouldn't get together. We wouldn't be friends. But we are. Why? Shalom. Because Jesus came. He brought peace among men with whom he's pleased. And he's pleased at us only because he was pleased in his Son. And his Son bore the wrath that we deserve. And so we believe. And we proclaim. And we encourage each other. I mean, to talk about the prospects for peace when you're in a community that really does buy into it and actually has a hope for the end of the world that means perfect peace. I mean, the UN can't promise that. The UN can be committed to worldwide peace. And in the end, the UN will not be. And Jesus will. So when we get together in home groups, when we get together to serve each other and to care for each other and to pray with one another, to study the Bible together, we have a hope that's greater than the money and the governments behind the UN. We have Jesus. That changes everything. He's the object of our worship. We share worship. We share epistemology, our source of knowledge, the Bible. We share our same views, not perfectly, but our general views of beauty and truth and justice and holiness and morality, because we have a standard and He spoke. But think about the spread of peace. Fifth point here is the spread of peace. It has to spread. We spread it out among ourselves in groups we call churches. We live it out before each other and live it out in the world. And yeah, it's messy, but it's to spread. You see it in verse 15 and following. Look at these verses, if you would, and then we'll be done. Verse 15, when the angels had gone away, the shepherds say to each other, let's go right away to Bethlehem and we'll see this thing that the Lord's made known to us. So they went and they found Mary and Joseph and the baby. Verse 17, and when they had seen this, they made known the statement which had been told them about this child. All through Luke 1 and Luke 2, you have several occasions of people seeing, believing, worshiping, going and telling. And that is a Christian tradition. Since these guys, since the prophets who were predicting it would happen, since the angels who were saying it was happening right then, and then from the shepherds and the wise men on, we are a tradition of people who go and tell. Partly because we're told to, partly because we can't help it. Anytime you see something, know something, hear something amazing, you can't help but speak about it. But also because it's part of His plan to spread peace, and so it's loving. In our omnitolerant age, where the only intolerance is for anybody who might be single-minded, who might be narrow-minded, who might think that there's one truth and one way. In that kind of age we live in, Christians often get chalked up as being really insensitive and way behind the times when they talk about getting other people to become Christians. But friend, the goal is not numbers. The goal is not getting more people to buy into our system. The goal isn't anything other than our love for you and shalom in your life, in your home, in your heart, in your head, in your eternity. So it's loving. And Jesus says you need to hear it. The question is what you'll do with it. Will you believe it? How will you respond to it? Christmas time is a time where we do all these things in Luke 2. We see, we hear, we remember, we rejoice, we believe, we worship, we proclaim. How are you doing those? There are really only a couple categories here. Christians who do this imperfectly. But you need to evaluate every year how you do it. You need to evaluate every day how you do it. Are you spreading shalom? Are you joining with Jesus and spreading peace among men of His good pleasure? Are you representing the joy of the kingdom, the celebration of the kingdom, the truth of the kingdom? Are you seeking justice in your home and in your community and in your own life? Are you seeking holiness and truth? And are you teaching these things to your children? Will your Christmas celebration tomorrow have an air of shalom about it? Or maybe you're not a Christian. Maybe you're not a Christian and you don't know this shalom. And so past Christmases have been sometimes celebrating, sometimes not. It's always awkward, a little dabbling in the spiritual, but you're not sure what to make of it. Doesn't this make sense? Maybe it makes sense to you for the first time. Maybe some things have clicked and you say, wow, that does explain a lot. The Christian faith does not have all of the answers to remove all mysteries. But friend, I think it answers those questions and focuses on those questions that we know are nagging questions in our heart and lives. It has an answer for why you pursue what you pursue, why you like what you like, why you do what you do, and why it isn't perfect. Why it isn't totally right. Why you're uneasy with it. Jesus is our shalom.